Uncle Philip, could you tell us how the Lord led you to build the auditorium, design the auditorium the way you did at Christ the Vance Mission? I'm sure we all find that fascinating.
Well, it's a bit of a long story. It started long ago when I was an atheist, and I was doing a research project in Nigeria, and it was a way to analyze cable structures. And in those days, computers were quite small, and problems like that took a huge amount of storage. And I was working on a way to be able to analyze cable structures with a relatively small amount of storage. And cable structures have the possibility of covering very large areas with very few internal supports. And well, by the time I'd finished in Nigeria, I had failed. It hadn't worked out. And when I came to South Africa, it was only to accompany a friend who was looking for a job. I had no intention of staying here. And while he was looking for a job, I looked over the universities where he was looking for a job. Everywhere I went, they offered me a job and I didn't want it. But eventually I discovered that the computer system at WITS was astoundingly good. And I went and tried it out, and it was so good I thought, well, on this system I'll soon finish my research. So I agreed to lecture at WITS, and I didn't succeed with the research program, but I met my wife and never left South Africa. Then I got converted, and I used to pray every morning. One morning I was praying, and the Lord suddenly spoke to me, and he said, that research project you were working on, it didn't work because you were doing it wrong. You should have done this. And I was astounded. First of all, I thought, that's surely not the sort of thing God talks to people about. And then I thought, but you know, it's a good idea. I'll try it out. So I did some calculations doing it that way, and it looked very, very promising. So I went to Free State University and said, look, I'd like to get on your computer. Can you let me use it? They said, no, but if you enroll for a PhD, you can use it as much as you like. So I thought, well, that's a good enough deal. And so I did, and I found that this method worked absolutely wonderfully. It was like magic. Everything worked out, and it was not only, this method was not only suitable for just cable structures, but all sorts of things this method worked well on. And at that time, my wife was mentally very in a very bad state, and she was completely deluded. She thought she was a German princess, and there were gangs of assassins out to assassinate her, and she was making life impossible for the detectives and for the police, and they didn't know how to cope with her anymore, so they called me in and said, look, we're going to have to lock your wife away. We just can't carry on like this. She's interrupting all our work with and disturbing lots of people. And I thought, my, that's very sad. Maybe if I take her to Cesar Banto, they'll be able to do something for her. So I went looking for her. She was in the building in town, and I found her in this lift and said, look, come with me, we must go to Cesar Banto. She said, but will it be safe there? Will he assassinate me there? I said, no, look, just get into the car, let's go. So we just got in and drove. And so we were at Cesar Banto, and I took the opportunity to talk to some of the counsellors, and one of them was a chap called Kurs Grief, and I was talking with him, and I said to him, look, I'm worried. I thought at one stage I could hear the Lord's voice, but now I'm not sure, because one morning I was praying, and what I thought was the Lord speaking said that I'd been working on a research project and I'd been doing it wrong. And that, sure, the Lord doesn't talk about things like that. And he said to me, well, what would this analysis be used for? So I said, well, it would be used for cable structures, like structures covering sports fields where you have a huge area and you don't want internal supports. So I said, oh, come with me. And off we went to see Uncle Erlo. And he was in his office and he was looking at the model of an auditorium which had been made by a German architect and sent to him. And so we came in, and Kurs introduced me as an engineer, and he said, oh, you're an engineer, what do you think of this auditorium here? So I looked at it, it was like a Zulu village, and it looked very attractive. So I said, well, it's going to look very nice, it's going to need a forest of columns inside to hold it up, but it will look attractive. And Erlo said, oh, well, that's no good at all. I don't want any columns in. I want to be able to see every person in that hall, and I want nobody to have anything to hide behind. So I said, oh, well, sorry, but this design won't work. And he said, can you design something with no columns inside? And I thought, aha! This is why the Lord showed me how to do that project, because now I can analyze it. And I said, well, let me go and make a model of the kind of thing I could do for you. And I had the idea in my mind exactly what I wanted to do. And when I got there, I was going to do the drawing, and then I thought, right, well, I'll pray and ask the Lord to direct me in this and help me. And immediately I had a vision of a building which looks almost identical to what stands there now. And I thought, oh, well, this must be some mistake, because it doesn't take any special analysis to do that. That's the kind of thing I've been teaching students to build for a long time. So I pushed that aside, And I went ahead and made my model, took it to Erlo, and he looked at this and said, wow, can you actually make something like that? I said, yes, if the foundation conditions are right. And I said, I'll go and survey Caesar Bantu and I'll check on the foundations and find out where it can be done. Now, there was one place where the topography was absolutely perfect for the thing I had in mind, the thing I made the model of. It was steeply sloping and it would need very little groundwork and all the seats would be able to look down to the creature, and it was a perfect situation for doing this structure. But there was excellent agricultural soil down to beyond the depth you could find. I dug pits there to see how deep it went, and I got so deep that I thought it was going to collapse, and so then I drove in reinforcing rods down below and knocked them in to see how far they would go. They just went all the way down. So I had to concede it wouldn't be possible to do the foundations for what I wanted. So I thought, well, I'll survey the whole of Caesar Bantu and look at the foundation conditions and see what can be done. And I did that, and when I had finished my investigation, I saw there was one place that was suitable for an auditorium, but it wasn't for suitable for my design. It was perfect for the thing I'd been shown in that vision. So I was a bit disappointed, but then I realized the Lord was showing me he can do anything, even when I get it all wrong. And I can rely on him. And so I did the design for the structure, and I just designed a shell, the shell which an architect would then come and make a structure out of. I was convinced that the Lord would send an architect, and there were actually a couple of architects who were associated with Caesar Bantu and who wanted to do it. But nothing happened. I was building the shell, and I then started on the drainage system, because a roof that big has an awful lot of stormwater to deal with, and you have to deal with it, otherwise it's going to deal with the building. And so there was a very extensive and complex stormwater system to get rid of all the drainage water, all the stormwater. And while this was going on, I was beginning to think, well, look, there's not much more I can do before we need an architect to design the building. And one morning, I was out there supervising constructing the drains at the back. You don't see them now, they're completely hidden under concrete. When you come out of the back of the auditorium, there is an area which is concrete. That is the drainage system. And there are steps going up so that if there are more people than there are seats for, they could still see right to the pulpit. And a man arrived, introduced himself as Jack de Blanche, and he said, I was in Cape Town, I was praying, and the Lord told me to put all my equipment in the car and go to Caesar Bantu. He said, I had no idea where Caesar Bantu is, I'd never heard of it, but I knew it was the Zulu name, So I got in my car and I came to Zululand, and when I came down the hill and I saw this construction, I realised this is where I was supposed to be. Now, this chap, Jack Blanch, he had started out in construction something like 30 years before, and he had done every construction job. He'd done bricklaying, he'd done steel fixing, he'd been done all kinds of concrete works. He had run a precast concrete yard, and he had done all the trades. And he came and said, well, look, he is confident the Lord sent him from Cape Town to come and work on this. Can he help me? So I thought, well, if he's got so much experience in construction, he'll know what can be done and what can't. And so I thought, well, look, if I do the architecture, he can tell me what he can do, and I can design the building around what he's capable of doing. Since there's no architect, I'll be the architect, and I'll just use his knowledge to design what can be constructed. And so everything to be done, I would go to him and say, look, how can you do this? And he'd say, well, I can either do this or I can do that. And I would turn it over and say, well, look, that would work well. So I started doing the architecture, and everything worked out, because everything I wanted to do, it was stuff that he'd already told me he could do it. And in fact, on that whole project, all the design work was done by my asking him what he could do when I showed him a drawing, and he told me what I could do, and I designed around it. And I don't know how many of you have been there, but the end sections, they're some very complex concrete. They are they're very tall, but it's the only place where light can come in. So instead of being closed wall, it's like a Venetian blind with lots of space and with small beams connecting with windows, and it allows light in beautifully. But it needed a lot of very skillful concrete work. And just when we got to the point of doing that, well, the Lord sent another man along, and he was an expert in concrete construction, a chap called Johan van Eck. And he came along and said, well, he feels there's something that the Lord wants him to do here. What is there, something he can help with? And I showed him the drawings, and he said, oh, yes, I've been doing that kind of thing for years. So everything to do with that, I can say the Lord led everywhere. It's his design. It ended up just like the design that he showed me when I prayed for guidance in the beginning. And at every stage, when you needed people to do things, the Lord sent them. From the very start, it was such a privilege to be on that site. I designed a structure in steel, and I made a list of all the steel that was going to be required, all the sizes, all the lengths. And I took it to Friedel. Those of you know Cesar Monti, he I don't know if he still is the second in command. He's now very old. He's probably retired. But he was the second in command there. And he took my list off to steelworks, supply place. And he gave them this list of materials and sizes. And they said, you know, this is amazing. We have got all these sizes. They were ordered in 1970, just when South Africa went metric. And this order came in, and it's in feet lengths. There's 20-foot lengths, 30-foot lengths. And we went metric, and everybody was told, you don't work in feet anymore. It's taboo. You work in meters. So they'd already cut this order in feet lengths, and the customer never turned up to buy them. So they'd been there in the yard for years. Nobody wanted to touch them. They're in feet lengths. So we could have them at the price of scrap.
Oh, my word.
And it was astounding. Not only were the sizes perfect, but there was enough of everything. And so all this steel arrived on site. Stacks of it going out into the sugarcane, and nobody had any idea how it was going to be made into my design. Now, a few months before this stuff arrived, I began hearing stories about a welder in Durban. This was at a shipyard. It was at a shipyard which did the Navy's spy ships. And the heart of these spy ships is the instrument room. And the instruments are so sensitive, they must be completely protected from stray electric and magnetic fields. So it all has to be done out of copper. And copper is not so easy to weld. So when they had these spy ships, they would get the best welder available to do the instrument room. And it usually took several months. Well, I heard stories about a welder called Baldy. And he had been given the latest instrument room to do, and he'd welded it in half the time that had been done previously, and he'd never stopped preaching all the way through his work. And I had no idea who Baldy was. But it turns out that he was a very good welder and a very bad man. He was married, but he had a lot of mistresses as well. And he was a hard drinker, and he was a hard drug user. And one of the people from Caesar Bantu, he had a sort of outpost in Durban. We all knew him as Umgodi. He had been trying for years to reach this chap, Baldy. And Baldy wouldn't, he wasn't interested, he didn't want to know. But he got home one night, drunk, drugged, and he found his wife had left him and taken the children, and there he was alone in his house, and he felt really miserable. And he saw a tape. In those days, people didn't have disc players, they had tape players, they had cassette tape players. And he found this cassette, and he remembered that Gotti had given it to him weeks earlier and said, please listen to this tape. It might change your life. Well, he put the tape in the machines and pressed play and collapsed in a heap on the floor. He was paralytic and he couldn't move, but he could listen to the tape. And it was a tape from Prassi's Abanti. And as he listened, he wanted to switch it off, but he couldn't, because he couldn't get up. He was paralytic drunk. And then as the tape wore on, he realized, but I'm on the way to hell. And he was absolutely shaken. And he said, I've got to change. I've got to get out of this, otherwise I'm on my way to hell. And as he was recovering with a very bad hangover the next morning, he managed to stand up and stagger to the door, and Oom Gotti was there. And he said, I need to go to see Zubantu. And he immediately said, get in the car. He drove him there, and as soon as he arrived, he got out of the car and saw Arno, and he felt, this is the chap I need to go and talk to. And he got saved, and he came to the Sunday services, and I met him there, and I knew him as David Kidd. Very nice chap. I didn't know him. I didn't know that he was baldy. He had a thick head of hair, so I didn't know he was a welder. But he arrived for the Sunday service, and he saw all this steel stretching out into the sugar cane. And he said, what's all this for? And we said, oh, well, it's for a big church. And he said, but who's going to manufacture all the steel? He said, well, we don't know. He said, well, I'll do it. Mm-hmm. And so we got the best welder in Durban. He's the best welder I have ever met. I've dealt with a lot of welding, but this was absolutely superb. And there's a carpenter there, a Swiss carpenter, a very good carpenter called Robert Maeder. And he came and looked at the drawings when I was showing David Kidd these drawings. And he said, you know, a carpenter can draw a line on a piece of wood and cut the middle out of that line. But even a carpenter couldn't make things to the accuracy of these drawings. He said, nobody's going to be able to make it. Well, David Kidd made all those members single-handed, and I checked them all. There wasn't a millimetre error in any of them anywhere. No, it was such a privilege to be anything to do with the Zubantu Auditorium. It was just so obvious, every single step of the way, the Lord was in it.
Sure. And how long did the whole project take?
Well, it took me about maybe 2 years to do the design, and then David Kidd came, and it took him about 3 years to do the manufacturing, and that was really amazing, because once this was underway, there's nothing I could do. So I went to Erlo and said, look, I've done the design, there's nothing I can do until the thing's manufactured. I will go and take a job, do some engineering. And he said, well, we're thankful for all the work you've done, and he prayed that the Lord would recompense me financially for all the work I'd done for nothing. And I went, and there was a job coming up in Lesotho. It was an American aid job. And US aid has very strict regulations. They only employ Americans and people from countries receiving American aid. But I had previously worked on the first stage of this project. It's the Southern Perimeter Road in Lesotho. And so I went to the person in charge and said, look, I worked on the original planning stages of this. How about letting me taking me on for this part of the job? He said, oh, there's no possibility. This is an American aid job. But tell me about this. I've not seen the countryside. What's it like? And so I explained it to him, explained what we had done. And I had with me all my plans, my surveys, everything that I'd done on the first one, and I showed it all to him, and he said, this is amazing. I've never even seen a map which shows where the road goes before. And he asked me all about the route, and I said, look, this happens here, that's a very difficult place. You'll need to set up a camp here, you'll need to set up a camp there, you can get water here, you can't get any water anywhere. And he said, you know, you've obviously got a lot of knowledge just about this area. I want you to work on it. I want you to take the job. And so I wasn't eligible because I wasn't American, I wasn't I wasn't from a country that receives American aid. But he wanted me there, and he swung it, so I got it. And it turned out to be a job that the people they had on site couldn't do. The design that they had been done from aerial photographs, and the mountains there are so steep that always one side of the valley was in shadow, so that you couldn't get contours off it. The maps were all wrong. And the road had been designed crossing gorges and going over cliffs. It was totally unbuildable. And they had nobody there who could redesign. Nobody could do the surveying necessary. And so the work all came to me. And this job brought me in more income than I had earned in any 10 years put together previously. And it was a wonderful experience. I would look out over these mountains every day and say, and they pay me to be here. Astounding. And they also wanted me to make provision to have a second team working under me. I said, that's fine, but I'm going to need extra equipment. They said, okay, we'll pay for the equipment. So I bought equipment for my other team, but I managed all the work myself, so it was never used. And it was exactly the stuff that turned out to be absolutely perfect for building Kwasi Zibantu. So, then, at the end then of the 3 years that David Kidd had taken to do the work, I'd finished and was there on the site, and I'd made enough money to see me through. I didn't need to rely on anything except the money I'd already earned for the rest of the job. And we made very, this whole thing is absolutely amazing. We made very good progress, and while we were building it, I became involved in the creation industry, because I was not only building the auditorium, but at that time the education system went pear-shaped. And the education system in Zululand was handed over to the Homeland Administration, and they insisted that they were going to have in all the schools Zulu culture, which includes ancestral spirits, worship and witchcraft. And the Christians said, hey, we can't send our children to schools like that. It's not going to happen. So the Zululand authority said, well, they either come to our schools and learn all about our Zulu culture, or they don't go anywhere. We're not having any other schools. So Erlo said, we can't have this. We must build a school. And we did. So I designed a school, and it was built, but there was no math and science teacher, so I was the only person with a math and science background, so I taught math and science while the building was going on. And a visitor came from Australia, and he said, I believe you're the science teacher here. I said, yes. He said, well, maybe you might like to listen to this tape. And it was a tape from Barry Setterfield, and it was all about the age of the earth and evolution and things like that, and showing that it's all untenable. And I thought, well, this is very interesting. And I could tell from this tape it was the commentary to a slideshow. And so I lent this tape to a number of people. So, look, this is very interesting. Have a listen. They said, well, we haven't a clue what it's all about. Now, I knew what it was about. When he mentioned what he was doing, I could see in my mind the slide, because I knew. I'd dealt with a lot of science in a lot of fields, and I'd studied biology, I'd studied geology, I'd studied astronomy, and all this stuff was about that kind of thing. So I had a picture in my mind. Every slide that he was showing, I knew what it was. But the other people I gave the tape to didn't. They said, well, we don't know what it's about. Can't you get the slides? So I sent to Barry Setterfield, and he sent a set of slides. So I would then set the slide projector up, set his tape running, and I would then change the slides whenever it was needed. And everybody said, well, this is all right, but he's got such a thick Australian accent, it's difficult to understand what he's saying. Won't you give the commentary? And I said, oh, well, if I were to give the commentary, I'd have to be sure it was all true, and I don't know. This is just what he says. And they said, well, can't you find out if it's true? And I said, it would take months of work in a university library to check through all this stuff. And just at that time, the local government authorities descended on Caesar Bantu and said, just look at this development that's going on. You have no license to be a township. And what about this enormous thing that's going up there? There's no license to build anything like that. And they were talking about the amphitheatre. They said, this must stop immediately. And so we were banned from doing anything. So I thought, well, since I can't do anything, and since there are cars going in from Caesar Bantu every morning, coming back every evening, I can go to the university and look up all this stuff. And so I did. And it held up the construction of the auditorium, but it enabled me to go through a huge amount of material in the university library and find out not only that everything Barry Setterfield was saying was true, there was much, much more. And so I decided, well, I won't just give Barry Setterfield's presentations, I'll give presentations on what I've been finding out. And well, I started giving presentations at Caesar Bantu, and the visitors went home and invited me to go and give presentations all over the country. And I ended up doing a lot of presentations all over the place. And unbeknown to me, people were making videos. I didn't know about it. And people were sending these videos all over. And so I started receiving invitations to go and lecture all over the world, starting off with Russia. So the time it took was delayed by these things, but they're all miraculously fitted together so that even the delays were absolutely essential for what happened afterwards. Well, then when we needed to do finishing, we needed seating, we needed things like lots of woodwork. And that also, everything turned out miraculously. A marvelous woodworking machine became available in Switzerland, and Robert Mader, he heard about this, he had no money, but he went to have a look and said, wow, this would be the perfect machine for doing all the woodwork in the auditorium. What a pity we haven't got any money. But a few months later, that machine arrived in Durban Harbour. Absolutely astounding. And so the actual structural frame was finished in about maybe 3 years of construction. But then the frame needed sheeting, and so I did the design on what the sheeting should be like, and because it's so big, each sheet had to go over at least one of the bends in the arcs, and that meant all the sheets had to be very long. They had to be rolled specially. And we went off to Iskor. And the fellow in charge, he was called Dr. Rocco de Villiers. And we showed him, we told him we were needing sheeting to build a church, and he said, well, you can get sheeting very cheaply, because what happens is when they set up the rolls to do an order, it's not economic to shut the machine down. So if they get to the end of the order and there's still a couple of hundred meters on the roll, they just let it go and they roll those sheets and then sell them off as offcuts. It's cheaper than stopping the machinery and trying to set up something else. So you can come and have a look at all our offcuts, and we had stacks of these things, and they were all short pieces. So I said, well, actually we have to have long pieces. And she said, whoa, No, you could use short pieces. So I showed him the photographs of the construction, and he looked at this in amazement. He said, wow, this is some place. Look at all the work you've done. Yes, you know, this can't possibly make use of short pieces of sheeting. It's got to be long sheets. Well, you leave it to me. And surprise, surprise, we got these long sheets at the price of offcuts, all rolled the right length, no questions asked. It all arrived on site, again at the price of effectively scrap. And then, well, that was all put up, and the thing was put into use, and it got into use. I suppose, well, it got covered up, shall we say, maybe a year later. But now, the inside was another problem, because it's a large area, and if it had been the original place I'd wanted to build my special thing, every seat would have been able to see the pulpit. But this is, it's on a level, it's a level with the hillside, so the sides are far away from the pulpit, and they are looking over other people. But the sides are a shallow gradient and the centre is a steep gradient. So everywhere the gradient's different. And so I had to design every bench so that the people behind could see over their heads. So in the auditorium, there are no two benches on exactly the same level except the one on the mirror image opposite side. Every bench, every platform had to be on its own level. And so it was a great deal of design work, it was a great deal of construction work. It took quite a long time to do it, but each step was made individually, and it was all done by Zulu labourers who could not read or write. None of them had ever done accurate work before. They'd poured concrete and they'd dug holes, but all this had to be done accurately. The level had to be right to a couple of millimetres. The platforms had to be right to very small limits to get it in. And these totally uneducated Zulus did it perfectly. They learned how to use tape measures, they learned how to work accurately, and that floor alone is a miracle. And then we came to put in the ceilings. And they were putting in the ceilings while we were still finishing the floor. And the ceilings are about 13 metres above ground level. It's high. And they're now over these steps that have been built. And the scaffolding was up there, and people were up on the top of the scaffolding fixing the ceilings. And I was talking to one of the people who was doing the steps that we were working on. And he looked in horror behind him, and there was a deadly silence throughout the whole place. I looked around, I didn't see what happened. What had happened was someone had fallen right from fixing the ceiling, 13 metres falling onto these concrete steps. He stood up, he walked back up the scaffolding and carried on fixing the ceiling. Everything about that construction was a miracle. Such a privilege to have anything to do with it. And then when the ceiling was finished, the building never got finished. Once the ceiling was up and the seating was there, it was possible to use it, so the finishing, it never got done. And it was used like that in its, shall we say, unfinished state for years. But nobody seemed to mind that it wasn't finished. It worked.
Mm-hmm. Uncle Philip, you would need some big equipment. Where did the equipment come from to lift up the
absolutely steel
girders and all that sort of thing?
I was absolutely confident that I had got the quantities for what we needed correct. And everything was correct, apart from one section. And one section, it was the smallest section used on the whole auditorium. There were about 40 metres left over. And I couldn't understand this. But when we came to do the erection, we thought we'll go and see about a second-hand crane in Durban. So when we were ready to erect, David Kidd's eye went off down to the shipyards to see what was available in parts of cranes or second-hand cranes or whatever. We went to construction sites, we went all over the place. And the closest that we came to finding a crane was a 4 meter section of a gantry crane, and the price was something like 20,000 rand. Now, in those days, that was a lot of money, but we didn't have anything like that, absolutely nothing like it. And new cranes were astronomical, but the closest we could get to something like a second-hand crane was this little section of gantry for 10,000 rand. So David said to me, well, can't we make our own crane? Well, I went and I looked at the leftover steel, and I found I could design a crane just big enough to lift the sections to the highest point with the material that was there. I could build the tower, but it needed a mechanism. Now, Manfred Stegen had a crane that he had made for lifting sugarcane. There was a trailer, a little frame with wheels, and it had a winch worked from the power takeoff of a tractor, and that winch went over this little tower and lifted up the sugarcane so he could put it on the lorry. And he offered this. He said, well, if you can get this to work, you can use that. So we cut off the little crane there, and we built a crane 15 meters tall. And that crane put every single member in that whole auditorium in place without a hitch.
Uncle Philip, I can just add, I remember Uncle Lula once made a comment when we were having the Minister's Conference in January 1991, remember right? And there was a gardener planting some trees, and one of the pastors stood there and said to him, what are you doing wasting your time? Jesus will have come long before any of these trees will have grown. This is January 1991. I mentioned this to Uncle Lula many years later, when the trees were very big as we were walking there. He said, oh, somebody said the same thing to my father 50 years ago when he planted a forest of trees which became the 5 kilometres of pews that the people are sitting on in this church.
Yes. That was amazing. I went to that farm fairly often. Not very often, but there was this section of trees which were an amazing age. Timber is harvested in South Africa at something like 12 years because it's not economic to leave it any longer. Now, the quality is poor because young timber is weak, but it's economic to do that. Now, these trees were something like 30 years old, and they were big, they were old, and they were excellent timber. And they'd never been harvested. And they were harvested for the auditorium, and there was just enough to do all the woodwork in the whole auditorium.
5 kilometres of wood, which made up seats for 10,000 people. And I thought, Philip, I believe you also designed it that a person could speak, projecting a voice well, without a PA system and be heard in the auditorium.
Well, that is part of the design which the Lord gave me. I knew nothing about acoustics, but we knew it was going to be a big problem. And so I took the drawings to an acoustics expert at Durban University and said, look, what do we have to do to make this acoustically sound? He said, well, I'll do some calculations, put it on the computer and see what I get. And he came back and said, this is amazing. The acoustics are astoundingly good. All you need to do is make an acoustic wall behind the pulpit and a very small section of the roof above it with a smooth surface, and you should be able to hear everywhere in this auditorium. He was amazed. He didn't, and it only turned out after he'd done his calculations and they told him it was like that. I had no idea. It was not my doing at all.
Oh. Uncle Philip, I also remember when you showed me around there how you were talking about the water that's going to come off this roof would wash away this valley, and how you dispersed, channeled, and spread out the water and did all those different layers in order to prevent washing away of the hillside, because, I mean, it's thousands of litres that just comes pouring off that roof in a rainstorm, isn't it?
So far there has been no damage anywhere.
It was just extraordinary, the amount of the channels and the gullies, and you've got all around the auditorium a lot of, platforms, water channeling.
Yeah, well, you can't see because it's all underground. When you come out of the front of the auditorium, you can see all the entrances. You can see all these holes where it's going into the system, but you can't see the system. But when this goes down the hill, it gains a lot of power because water going downhill does. But just before it reaches the basin, the gradient is brought to nothing, and it heads straight for a buttress, which is it splits the current, breaks the force, and directs it over to the next one. So instead of being a straight down rush of water, it's all split up into little streams which circulate and don't do any damage. And no damage has been done.
And then, Uncle Philip, I also remember you telling me when you were showing it around that because of the amount of rainwater coming on corrugated iron roof, just what a tremendous noise it would be. So you mixed sand with the paint so that it's more pointy to break up the raindrops on a roof so that it wouldn't be as heavy of a thud and not undermine the noise or undermine the talking and singing inside the auditorium. That's something I think most of us wouldn't have thought of either.
No, but it worked pretty well. You don't get the sound of rain hitting corrugated iron. It's more like the sound of rain hitting concrete, because the sand breaks up the drops. Mm.
Well, that's nice. Did it not burn down at some point? And I was both with flies.
Yeah, 2008.
Yes. Well, this is what comes of not finishing off, because in the finishing off, my all my curtains were flame-proof material. Mm-hmm. And I told them, this is the one thing you've got to be careful of, because if there's a fire in there, then steel loses its strength quickly. So everything there must be fireproof. And after I left, that seems to have been completely ignored, and eventually somebody very foolishly left an electric fire with blankets and things and clothes in front of it and went out. It all caught fire, and that set alight to the living area, which was over the backstage area. And since nothing there was flame-proof, all the superstructure collapsed. Now, that the superstructure is a very important part of it, but it's not the major part of the work. All the drainage, the end walls, which were a very major construction, they were all concrete. The back walls, the front walls were concrete, the back walls and the rooms were brick. So the only thing that was damaged was the steel. And as far as I'm concerned, it was wonderful, because by this time the auditorium was so well known and so well loved by so many people that vast numbers of people donated towards rebuilding the superstructure, and they also volunteered their time and effort in doing proper finishing. So it was really quite amazing. There was an Austrian firm who agreed to do a replacement roof in wood, and they asked for my drawings. So I gave them the drawings, and they were going to design the best superstructure they could arrange using timber. And they wrote back and said, well, they can't improve on my designs, so they're going to make it just the same. And they sent over an engineer to do the measurements, because they say, we're going to manufacture it here, and it needs to all fit together there, but that will only work if we know the exact dimensions. So I said, my dimensions are on the drawing. And they said, well, yes, but construction is never the same as what's on the drawing. It's always different. So they came out, and their engineer measured it up, and he said he could not find 1 millimetre wrong in any of the dimensions. So they could make everything exactly the same. They didn't have to say, well, this goes there, this goes there. They said the whole lot could go anywhere.
Wow. And it is now with, like, wood that doesn't take fire as easily, right?
No, wood will burn, but when wood burns, the outside chars, and that doesn't burn. It forms a heat-proof barrier to the unburned wood underneath it. So if you have a fire, it damages the wood, but it doesn't all collapse.
Well, in fact, Uncle Ola, we've watched the 20-minute video of the burning of Casby Auditorium, which was filmed in real time. In the fire brigade, we were taught that any building, if all the doors are open, no matter what the size, would be destroyed irrecoverably in 20 minutes. Doesn't matter if you're talking about a warehouse or a house. If all the doors are open, that's why you need fire doors in hospitals and hotels and so on. And watch this, and sure enough, in 20 minutes, everything's collapsing. And how every single fire extinguisher in the building had not been serviced. They were all 18 years old, not serviced, none of them worked. So we used it as an example of, you know, how to prepare ourselves and how to deal with things, and made us also recheck our wiring. Because that same year, Kwasibantu's main building in Malmesbury burnt down as well. And when the main house burned, all electricity of the entire mission farm was going through their one box, which was glowing white and humming, and they all knew it had to be upgraded. But of course, when the fire started, all electricity went out. They had no plumbing. They couldn't even operate a pump to be able to operate a hose pipe to try and put out the flames. And of course, they didn't have fire extinguishers, the current, and so on. And the very next year, 2009, back to the Bible's main office block and house with all their records burnt down, also electric fire. So you had three major mission buildings in one calendar, one 12-month period, burned down. So we and many others took warning to rewire our place, and everything was old. And just the danger of the wiring and the heating, and then the fact that most missions don't see a high priority, or didn't, of having enough fire extinguishers and fire drills and so on. Mm-hmm. It seemed to me that many of the people at Kwasibantu hadn't been there for the building, had taken the auditorium for granted, and were given a chance in 2008 to be part of the restoring and finishing of the structure, which you'd laid all the excellent groundwork for. So there's a lot of lessons of what to do and what not to do for missions. So as you said, maybe a lot of good came out of people's foolishness or lack of foresight in that case.
Yes, when the auditorium was being finished, I said to everybody, we must make sure that no combustible material is used in this building, because a steel building loses its strength very quickly. But I think Robert Mader was typically said, oh, the Lord will look after it. Now, when it caught fire, Angela immediately phoned me and said, well, the place is on fire. What should we do? I said, get out, because it's going to collapse very quickly. Make sure everybody gets out. It is going to fall down. And she said, sure, but it's so strong. I said, get everybody out. It's going to collapse. So they did get out, and it did collapse. You know, one can't take shortcuts. If you're going to use steel, you've got to be aware that it rusts, and you have to maintain it, and it loses strength with heat, so you must not have combustible material in it. You ignore things like that at your peril.
That's an incredible story. Has this ever been put in writing, the testimony of how all the different components and ingredients and experts came together?
Well, I suppose that's a possibility.
But it just isn't print yet. Because I've never known all of these. I've heard little bits and pieces here, never got the whole story before.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe it might be there. I need to get it down in print.
Wouldn't it be possibly an idea, Peter, for Uncle Philip to record it?
Well, we just have recorded it.
Well, there we go.
Yes. Well, thank you so very much, Uncle Bob. Did anyone else have any other questions?
The present oratorium, why is there no echoes in a building that large?
That's because the acoustics are so good. Referring to the echoes, that there should be echoes in a volume that large.
Well, I've never been an expert in acoustics, but the chap that we went to see said this is pretty well a perfect design. It will just need the acoustic wall, and it will need some drapes of some kind just to absorb the echo at the back. And I don't know if you remember it, but we used to have things hanging from the catwalks and the gallery, and they were useful because you could divide it into a smaller place. If you were having a smaller gathering, you could just use that central part between the catwalks and the, then the curtains could just be pulled up when you didn't need them, and they absorbed all the echo.
One more question, Uncle Philip. How did your wife fit in as Bossy's Lanterns?
She did quite well. I think from then on, nobody has ever suggested that she's a danger to society, or she should be permanently locked away. We've been very happy. We're very thankful. And there used to be a German chap who would come every year, and the first time he came, Margaret had just arrived, and she was a very difficult person. And so every year he would come, and he would find that she is quite a nice person, and say, "You are the miracle for my own eyes."
Thank you. John, would you close the prayer for us, please?
Yes.
Lord God, we thank you for your word. In your word we are nourished. We learn more about you and what you want from us. We thank you for your word this afternoon that you brought to Philip Stott. And I pray that we would learn many lessons from Elijah and Elisha and be open to the way that you are leading and guiding us. We thank you for the life and testimony of Dr. Stott and the way that he has been open to your guidance many times in his life. And I pray, Lord, that you would continue to use him mightily and powerfully. I pray that as he gets himself ready for UCT later, that he would take some time now to rest, and that he would be ready to present your truth. I pray, Holy Spirit, that you would guide him, and that you would empower him, that he would exalt Jesus Christ in all that he says, that he does, and the way in which he says and does these things. And Father, I pray that you would be with him as well on Friday as he speaks to the homeschoolers and their parents and addresses us on different issues. I pray that you would help him to speak to the hearts of people and also inform their minds. I also pray, Lord, for his family, that you would continue to look after them and provide for them. And I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you.